A union official was executed in his home not long after a strike by union membership. No one in the neighborhood heard any gunshots. It would take a forensic sound test, an electron microscope, and a nightgown to explain why. Nine-year-old Joe Doyle was an official of the local AFSCME, a union representing government employees.
It could be the most bitter, cold day in the world, and if he thought you were cold, he'd take his shirt off and give it to you, even if he didn't know you. Now, he also, as big as he wasn't afraid to tell you exactly what he thought.
He got into people's faces. He was a wonderful guy. They either loved him or they might have hated him.
Joe and his wife, Katie, had been married for about 8 years. On July 30th, 1998, the couple went to a private club after work for drinks. Early the next morning, Katie phoned police in a panic.
County 911, what is your emergency?
I need some help. My husband won't move, and there's, blood around him and stuff.
Did you hear him fall or anything?
No, he's laying in bed on his stomach. I went in to wake him up for work.
Okay. All right, we'll get somebody right there.
Thank you.
Don't touch anything.
All right.
Joe Doyle had been shot at close range. It was an execution-style killing.
When someone's dead with four gunshot wounds to the head, the first question that anyone's going to ask is, did this person have enemies? Because obviously it wasn't a friend that did this.
There was no sign of forced entry. And Joe's empty money clip was on the floor, which, according to Katie, had contained approximately $1,800. The first suspect in a murder like this is always the surviving spouse. Katie's hands were tested for gunshot residue, which would have been present had she fired a gun. The test was negative. Katie told police that they got home from the club around 8:30, had dinner, then went to bed. Around midnight, Katie said she went to sleep in an adjacent bedroom.
It was because of Joe's really, really, really loud snoring that she couldn't take it. She tried to get to sleep, and she lay there for an hour or so, but she finally had to leave and go into this next door bedroom because of the snoring.
The next morning, when Katie went in to wake her husband, she found him dead under the covers. Katie insisted she didn't hear any gunshots. Neither did any of her neighbors.
One of the funniest things in the case was that no one heard the gunshots. No one. We really did not have any good evidence of any hearing of gunshots that night.
It's possible a silencer could have been used. It could be a professional type of silencer that is affixed to the gun.
Police couldn't help but notice the amount of dust in the Doyles' home and wondered whether this might help track the killer's movements and ultimately reveal his identity. After the murder of 39-year-old Joe Doyle, friends and family told police that his marriage to wife Katie seemed solid. The couple were building an addition to their house and planning for the future.
Katie is telling the police that Joe was the love of her life, that she loved him more than you could love anyone, that everything was perfect in their marriage, that they just had sex the night before he was killed.
Joe and Katie both worked at the same hospital, and their co-workers gave police a different picture of their relationship.
Katie was having a brazen affair with a co-worker, that she was basically flaunting that relationship, that she told people that she was obsessed with Jordan, that she wanted nothing to do with her husband, that her husband was controlling, that George was the love of her life.
George Lewis was a groundskeeper at the hospital, and police found evidence the two were more than just lovers.
She purchases jewelry for him. She gives him a $1,000 down payment for a vehicle. She purchases clothing for him. She does everything for him, really.
Katie admitted the affair, but her lawyer says it meant nothing.
It was a fling. It was not brief, but it was not a motive for murder.
At the crime scene, police found a clue in the nightstand next to the bed. In the nightstand was a lockbox. Marks in the dust indicated the box had recently been moved, but no fingerprints were found. Missing from the box was Joe Doyle's 9mm Makarov pistol. This is one of the four bullets recovered from Doyle's body, deformed by impact. When a handgun is fired, the bullet spins as it travels through the barrel. The soft outer shell is scored by a corkscrew line cut into the barrel, a process known as rifling.
It causes the bullet to rotate on its longitudinal axis, given an aerodynamic stability while it's in flight.
The line cut into the bullet is called a groove. The spaces between the grooves are called lands. These lands and grooves are different for each make of gun. Investigators wanted to know whether this bullet was from a pistol like the one owned by Joe Doyle. Using a comparison microscope, forensic scientists compared the bullet from Joe Doyle's body to one fired from a Makarov pistol.
On the Makarov, it has four lands and grooves with the right twist, and there are not many firearms that have those class characteristics.
The results were clear. Joe had been killed with the same model 9mm pistol that he had once owned but was now missing.
The bullets were consistent with being fired from this model. So that was the evidence with the gun. That's what they started with. And on the defense side, we established that there were at least 3,000 other guns of this make and model alone that existed in our state, about 14,000 in the country.
Police then looked into Joe's union ties.
There recently had been a strike with the union, and the victim was involved in some of the activities regarding that strike.
It was a strike by state employees. Joe had the potentially dangerous task of repossessing the state-owned cars driven by the striking members.
People can be volatile, tempers flare up during a strike situation, one person against another. There could have been some problems between him and one of the people whose cars he repossessed.
Joe, in some sense, was viewed as this type of tyrant. He had to confiscate vehicles. Tensions ran high. Arguments occurred, that sort of thing. And it's a typical union scenario.
At the same time, Katie told investigators that her husband was involved in Project Children, an organization which brings children from Northern Ireland to the United States for summer vacations.
Here's a guy who travels to another country, to a hot spot in the world, a bed of terrorism, a bed of strife. I think anyone with common sense would look into this and see if there's a connection here.
Well, the fact that he was executed in his own bed, most likely at night while he was sleeping, and no one seemed to have heard shots, led people to believe, geez, they might have used a silencer, that, you know, it was an execution. This could be as a result of his ties with the IRA, if he had ties.
The investigation took forensic scientists from the United States all the way to Northern Ireland. But the real evidence was right in Joe Doyle's backyard. Police investigating the murder of 39-year-old union official Joe Doyle pursued every possible lead, looking into his union activities over the past several years, as well as his involvement with a charity in Northern Ireland. police couldn't identify anyone angry enough with Doyle to want him dead. So they looked once again at his wife, Katie, and her lover, George Lewis. Research into Katie's background found evidence of substance abuse and financial disagreements.
Joe was tough on Katie. Katie had had a drug problem years before. Joe caught her. Joe didn't trust Katie anymore, didn't trust her with the money.
No relationship's perfect. This one certainly wasn't a perfect relationship. They're going to take a microscope and examine the spouse, their entire life, and they're going to try to dig up any piece of dirt possible.
Her boyfriend, George Lewis, had an alibi for the night of Joe Doyle's murder.
George basically was a real lover. He had other girlfriends besides Katie, apparently. And so he was out with one of his girlfriends that night.
Two people alibied him. The first one, which would be for the earlier part of the evening, was with the other woman with whom he was having an affair. And then for the later part of the evening was with his wife.
As for Katie Doyle, she said that she had sex with her husband that night and later left to sleep in an adjacent bedroom because of Joe's snoring. The door was shut and the air conditioner was running, and she claimed she never heard the shots.
The head of her bed would be resting against a wall. That wall is the same wall that separates her room from the bedroom where the victim is sleeping, which puts them in extremely close proximity to each other, a matter of feet.
The distance was 15 feet, separated by a 5-inch wall and a closet. Investigators brought in Dr. Harry Holeen, a forensic audio expert, to test Katie's claims. On a shooting range, Holeen fired a Makarov 9mm pistol and recorded the sounds.
When you fire a gun, you explode some gunpowder in a cartridge in a barrel, and that explosion is very rapid. So the acoustic signal coming out of the barrel as the bullet comes out of the barrel very rapidly, the acoustic signal also is one that's very abrupt.
The Makarov generated between 118 and 120 decibels of sound.
And it'd be comparable to a motorcycle, a heavy bus close by, a power lawnmower, a chainsaw, things such as that.
But the sound created by a gun is of short duration. Would Katie Doyle have heard it? To find out, Holeen used two adjacent bedrooms in his house. He then put the recording he had made of the Makarov pistol in one bedroom and a sound meter in the other bedroom. If the shot was 118 decibels, 60% of that sound, approximately 70 decibels, reached the other bedroom.
If you're asleep, there's a very good chance that it would wake you up.
And forensic scientists found another discrepancy in Katie's story. Katie said she left Joe's bedroom around midnight and that she found him dead at 6 a.m. But forensic scientists found alcohol in Joe's stomach. The alcohol he consumed at the club would all have been absorbed in his body had he been killed after midnight. The medical examiner estimated the time of death was closer to 10 p.m. This could easily explain why neighbors didn't hear the shots. The ambient sounds of televisions, radios, and stereos at that time of night could easily have muffled them. Next, investigators wanted to test Katie's nightgown that was found on the floor next to Joe's body. Pulling the trigger creates a small explosion when the primer ignites the gunpowder, which in turn propels the bullet. Gases from that explosion create a small cloud about 3 to 5 feet in diameter that usually wafts back over the shooter.
The gases from the primer escape from the firearm through any available opening in the form of a gas or a vapor It then solidifies into tiny particles which are deposited on the hands, clothing, or the immediate proximity of the discharge.
Using an aluminum disc with a permanent adhesive, scientist Skip Schwobel lifted samples from the surface of the nightgown. Next, he removed the stud from its plastic holder and placed it inside a scanning electron microscope. The particles are magnified and scanned to reveal their chemical makeup. On Katie Doyle's gown were thousands of particles seen here magnified 4,000 times. They were made up of lead, antimony, and barium, the chemical components of gunpowder.
It's not natural in the environment. When those three particles are fused together, that's unique to gunshot residue.
Schwobel also found gunshot residue on the bedding next to the body.
Gunshot residue is going to get on the bed and on items on the bed. Katie said that before she left that room and went to the other room to go to sleep, she took her nightgown off, threw it on the bed. She doesn't recall where she threw it on the bed. It was dark.
With no gunshot residue on Katie's hands and gunshot residue on the bedding as well as her nightgown, prosecutors had no forensic evidence Katie Doyle fired the pistol. And without forensic evidence, prosecutors had plenty of suspicions, but very little proof. Police believe Katie Doyle lied when she told them her husband was alive when she left his bedroom around midnight. An analysis of his stomach contents put the murder closer to 10 p.m. According to their home phone records, someone called for Joe shortly after 10 p.m., and what Katie told the caller was revealing.
She said that the victim couldn't come to the phone because he was toast. In other words, he was intoxicated, and that's why he couldn't talk on the phone.
There was no gunshot residue on Katie's hands, but her nightgown found on the floor did test positive for gunshot residue, and so did the covers on the bed. So Skip Schwobel decided to analyze the nightgown to study the exact concentrations and placement of the residue.
Well, 20 years ago, when we didn't have the automated analysis by scanning electron microscope, a sample could take 12, 13 hours looking at it manually. Today, we're able to look at many thousands of particles in a short period of time.
Those tests revealed large amounts of residue on both the right and left front chest area, consistent with where a gun would be positioned. That was all the evidence police needed.
The significance of the gown is the reason why I arrested the victim's wife for the murder of her husband.
Prosecutors think they know the motive for the murder.
She was head over heels over this guy. She didn't want Joe anymore. I mean, this is your standard one spouse not wanting to be married.
The forensic evidence shows that Joe Doyle was in bed sometime before 10 p.m. Prosecutors believe Katie went into the bedroom, took her husband's 9mm pistol from the lockbox, then fired four shots into his head at close range. The invisible gunshot vapor drifted backwards towards her and settled on her nightgown. Katie took off her nightgown and threw it on the floor to show police the two had slept together. But it was proof of something else, proof that she had worn it while killing her husband. Katie had 7 or 8 hours to leave home and get rid of the pistol. The next morning, neighbors said Katie's car was in a different parking spot from where it was the night before. According to telephone records, Katie called her boyfriend 3 times on the night of the murder. Prosecutors don't believe the boyfriend was involved.
If she even acknowledged and admitted that she had gotten in touch with George that night, if he had any role in it, we have no proof of it.
Katie Doyle was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. Her lawyer maintains Katie is innocent, but he has no idea who killed Joe Doyle.
Why are we looking at Kate? Because she's the wife, because the police don't want to get outside the house, because that's their mode of investigation. And they're stuck there. And they're stuck there to this day.
Investigators say science leaves no doubt about the killer's identity.
It's much harder to get away with a crime today than it was years ago. We have instrumentation, preparation techniques that are much more advanced now. We can do particle extractions from clothing, from hands, and it doesn't have to be specifically gunshot residue.
If it wouldn't have been, with the work that Skip Schwoebel did with the microparticles that were found on the nightshirt that she had been wearing the night that this occurred, we probably would have never had enough information to make an arrest, let alone to get a conviction.
I'd rather rely on science in every case than on a human being. Science, especially when you can get different areas of science all pointing to the same suspect, is key to any prosecution.